Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. This is Terry Patton. I'm the creator and host of this series. For anybody who doesn't already know me, I'm the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a rich and probing public dialogue about how spirituality and higher consciousness can help us rise to meet the challenges of our current crises so that we can make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. I've now held over 90 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. Today, you'll hear me in conversation with Andrew Harvey. We're going to continue that discussion, listening in on a conversation Andrew and I had some weeks ago, which we've titled Reckless Love and Friendship at the Edge. You'll hear us in conversation for about 40 minutes. Then I'll make a few announcements and we'll resume for another 35 minutes. Because this is pre-recorded, we won't take questions, so the total broadcast will last about an hour and 20 minutes. It's one of my favorite dialogues, though. I assure you it's juicy, even though pre-recorded. Andrew Harvey is an author, speaker, the founder and director of the Institute of Sacred Activism, really one of the most eloquent, learned, passionate, ecstatic, remarkable voices in contemporary spiritual discourse. He was born in South India in 1952, where he lived till he was 9, and at the age of 21 at Oxford University, he became the youngest person ever to be awarded a fellowship to All Souls College, England's highest academic honor. He became disillusioned with life there and returned to his native India, where a series of mystical experiences initiated his spiritual journey. And over the next 30 years, he plunged into different mystical traditions to learn their secrets and practices, including deep extended study and practice of Hinduism and Tibetan Buddhist practice. He collaborated with Sogyal Rinpoche in writing the classic Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. He did deep study of Rumi and Sufi mysticism, which produced some of the most magnificent translations, or rather recreations of Rumi's poetry. And he's a passionate sacred activist, which is really the focus of his work now. Andrew and I have always been able to converse frankly and passionately and catalytically, and yet over the last few months, our practice of sacred conversation has begun to venture into more and more bold, wild, fruitful territory. Edgy. And we decided to start recording them and also to begin to teach together. We're going to be co-leading a four-day seminar in the San Francisco Bay Area, March 5th through 8th of 2015. This is the first of these basement tapes, and the conversation ranges widely. It starts in the middle of things, informally, since we had been talking about recent shocking news about some ISIS beheadings. Well, Andrew, I'm appreciating what you just had to say about just going into prayer and Tonglen as you listen to the news.
Well, this is what I'm advising everybody I talk to do, because it's quite clear that the world is erupting in chaos on every level, in very dangerous chaos. We see the enormous madness exploding in Iraq, and I've just been watching footage of al-Baghdadi, who seems to me much more terrifying than Osama bin Laden, because he's perfected the horrible cocktail of fake holiness and absolutely ruthless violence. We're looking at the shattering killing of this beautiful young man, black man, in St. Louis, and the eruption of the riots. And we're facing an intractable Middle East problem in which both sides are absolutely unable to come to any sane conclusion, with potentially worldwide danger. So what are people to do? There's very little that an individual can do, but we do have the power of what I call inner activism. I believe absolutely, finally, and forever in the immense power of prayer. This is something I have experienced at the deepest level myself. There are studies which show the power of prayer to work non-locally. And, of course,
yes,
all the
and not just on people in hospital beds, but even on tissue cultures, yeah.
Exactly. So what I'm saying to everybody is do not let the chaos and madness overwhelm you. That's what the dark wants. The dark wants a completely paralyzed, confused humanity, impotent and desperate. Use the power of prayer, and especially the great power of the Tibetan practice, Tonglen, which for me is the cornerstone of sacred activism. I teach it all over the world. I've been taught it by His Holiness himself, who uses it every day to center his whole being in the power of unconditional compassion. And if you do use Tonglen while you're watching the news, and in your depths of your practice, imagine the pain that you're witnessing coming towards you as a ball of big black smoke and dissolve it in the open expanse of your serene and stainless, deathless divine heart, and then send back to the beings in torment in the screen all the truth and glory and power and passion of your and their innate divine nature, you will be acting on the invisible levels in ways that will not only give you strength, but also help the forces of the creation of a new birth work in secret truth.
You know, this this time is particularly poignant because not only are all those things happening, but people are desperately, desperately poor, and thousands of them are trying to get into our country and into Europe. And the floods of people in extremis just desperately trying not to be in a place and in a circumstance of deprivation and violence. The utter breakdown of our ability to have a heartfelt and civil conversation that includes them in our hearts, in our political circumstance, is going on in the midst of all this. So there's a, I think, a deep riddle, and I wanted to ask you about this, because among the people who are speaking widely on this inner activism, you're probably the voice that is most willing to be full of intense feeling. Let the emotion and the care and the brokenheartedness really roil. And yet so many of the people who are in our conversation, or particularly those who are schooled in, usually in Theravadan Buddhist schools, are finding, you know, their way to a kind of sanity that really comes, you know, comes into contact with reality in a much cooler mode. And it really is the freeing and cooling power of awareness and acceptance and spaciousness that is the medicine that gets applied. And how we come into a deep knowing of our way of being as feeling beings with the intensity of this moment in a way that is purified and clarified by that true water of space awareness, and yet is not in any way bypassing or numbed or abstracted from the intensity of what's happening here in embodied form.
I hear you, and I would say that what is our challenge is to combine the profound coolness and spaciousness and openness to divine peace that is characteristic, say, of Advaita and the Theravadin approach with the sacred fiery passion of Christ consciousness and the Sufi vision of the beloved. We need to be both profoundly calm and profoundly passionate, so that we can be flames of authentic divine passion, which is always grounded in calm. I like to give the analogy of a candle. The flame of the candle can only burn steadily and for a long time if there is a lot of golden wax to feed from. So for me, when I go out to teach sacred activism, both the inner activism of prayer and meditation directed to healing the world and the outer activism of action founded and grounded in sacred consciousness, what I always say to people is begin with establishing a foundation of peace. Begin by doing whatever cool practices truly work for you, whether they are meditation or breathing practices. And of course, the Theravadins have mastered a whole array of these practices. But don't stop there. And this is my challenge to the Theravadins. Don't stop there. When you have established that foundation of peace, dare to plunge into what the litany of the Sacred Hearts calls the Sacred Heart, the burning furnace of charity. Dare to open your heart to the agony of the world. Dare to blaze with that agony and dare to allow the sacred outrage to rise in you. But make sure that when it does, it's purified by the peace so that it can become compassion energy, fierce and holy. This is the way of the great warriors of love, such as Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and of course His Holiness himself, who in his own practice combines the deepest detachment with the profoundest active compassion.
Mm.
His Holiness once said, cultivate the deepest detachment so that you can have the deepest capacity to care and act from compassion. And I think that's the definitive statement for our time.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I go into this just in my own practice, I notice that there are two aspects of the intensity of feeling that each function in important and very different ways in my own inner life. There is something that I think you just beautifully described, a kind of furnace that's alive with passionate care and resonant with the agony and pain of the world, and it's about intensity of feeling. But then there's also a kind of disarming, tender, it's a place of simply being touched. It's more, rather than being as active as that passionate quality you described, it's deeply receptive and opening and vulnerable. It is that which lets my whole view of everything just sort of be penetrated and be opened. And it has a different
love,
quality.
It's really allowing yourself to be in love with reality, and in love with reality in the tenderest, most vulnerable, most naked way, in love with the light, in love with animals, in love with one's friends, in love with one's lovers.
And allowing that love out. Yeah,
and present
to the unknowable depths beyond, you know, as much as I have been transformed by so many moments of gnosis and of communion and of deep, you know, deep, you might say, ultimate experience, that place where I am suddenly humble before that which is unknowable, which can surprise me, which can reformat my hard drive, which can take me beyond the known, and that I'm alive in that, and that beginner's mind, that childlike, you know, heart of innocence, that's really a little different, and it feels so important. It's really when I am able to participate in that way, and I think often in teaching, when the room becomes that tender and that open, and we are all present to the miraculous sacred who is right now ready to show up in a way that can and will change everything.
I hear you, and I feel that that is the core of enlightenment. I don't think that enlightenment, in fact, I know that enlightenment is not a series of dazzling experiences that is penultimate to enlightenment. For me, enlightenment is what I would call the steady state of attention to the presence in the present. And that is the key to becoming awake and staying awake. Kabir says, "No need to grieve, my friend, for what must pass. Find what always stays and cannot leave. Behind the turbulent dance of the world, the banner of his peace is always unfurled." And that, I think, is an absolutely crucial message to all of us at this time, because unless we're going beyond the experiences into this steady state of attention to the presence in the present, we are always the victim of even the higher emotions, the more intense emotions. They will shatter us in a crisis as extreme as this, unless they're grounded in this profound, loving, vulnerable, peaceful openness to the unknowable mystery, to the One. So I hear you, and I'm so thrilled that this has come to you, because it's coming to me too. I live in a log cabin in Arkansas, surrounded by green fields. I see deer and raccoons and armadillos. I have two beautiful, very naughty cats. And what I am living here for is to build up an unshakable reservoir of peace, so that the passion with which I speak, the passion that I'm trying to evoke in human hearts, can come from an ever deeper place, and so that I can model what the Dalai Lama is modeling at the highest level, this perfect marriage of the steadiest, calmest, most ordinary, most humble attention with an absolutely calmly fiery commitment to compassion in action. This is the fusion that I think all seekers now, whatever their path, are being called to.
Andrew? Hello?
Yes.
I'm here. Your voice disappeared for just a couple seconds.
I think it's the fusion that we're all being called to, don't you? I think it is the only way in which we can stay grounded as the world is torn apart to be remade.
Mm-hmm. And not just to stay grounded, but somehow to stay, well,
in love.
For me, it isn't even a staying. You know, it's actually
it's
that
it's flowing, isn't it?
Yeah, I have to be. I have to rediscover it anew. I have to have that purity that meets the new moment, or that discovers the new moment, the next moment, always the next moment, because the now that's known is past, and has this kind of willingness and trust. Like there is a kind of passion that's necessary in order to really give it all up and be present with those childlike eyes of surprise to the new moment, and a willingness to be love and intelligence and courage and generosity in whatever ways I know how to in that next moment, for that next moment to be a sacred encounter, an encounter with the beloved, but also a place where I can do some kind of service, where I can discover the unique way that moment is going to offer me a chance to be love.
I hear you. I think that's a very important point you've made, because so often the state of being present to the presence in the present moment is described as cool. I don't find it cool at all. It has a cool base. But the passion that you need to clear away all the barriers to love constantly is perhaps the most important of all the spiritual passions. It's an austerity, a rigor of passion, which you need, because otherwise you'd be constantly distracted by trauma or your own thoughts or the complexities and ambiguities of the world. And if you can stay, I'm finding, in this state of flowing with the moment, then each moment becomes an opportunity for service.
Mm.
You can be in service of the beloved, looking out as I'm looking out now at a field that's flooded with light, because your whole heart can respond to the beauty and say wordlessly a huge thank you to the beloved for that beauty.
Yes.
You can be in a queue in Safeway and be responding to the loneliness, to the courage, to the batteredness of the people around you with secret compassion.
Yeah.
And you can meet every being that you meet in the course of your day from this place with renewed alertness and the desire to make whatever exchange you have an exchange that lifts their souls. And this is the way of the lovers, isn't it? This is the way of the awake.
And for me, this is bridging out to a sense that even though I am profoundly, reverently aware of the greatness of made humble, you know, by everything that I can learn, that, you know, that there are such great beings like His Holiness, but many, many others that have gone before, and so any arrogance is inappropriate, and yet We're in a moment in which the human heart and spirit is being called to take responsibility for human affairs in a way that has really never happened before. The crisis is asking for something that has never happened before to happen. And I can't be present to that except in the mode of trusting that this is part of the perfection of the manifestation of the beloved, and that therefore the potential for that to happen is real, and that it is coming forward. And it isn't coming forward in this age in the way it did during the years when you and I came into our adulthood and on the path. It isn't a spiritual landscape that's studded with great big transmitters like my teacher Adi Da or the the 16th Gwalior Karmapa or Swami Nityananda and Muktananda and Ramana, the Anandi Mayama, these great, amazing dynamos of transmission were the nature of the spiritual landscape for a long time. And yet now, in this particular moment, it does seem to be about the next Buddha may be a Sangha, that that the teacher is now needing to be a student and a teacher, that we need to into a kind of sacred collaboration, that we actually have to begin to be communing with that unknown next moment it is emergence, it is the creative dance of our humble giving of ourselves in this moment, so that the thing that we never had thought before, that isn't there in the existing body of things we could study or quote, can find its way through our lips, and that can somehow be heard, that we're innocent enough that it can touch us and change us, so that this conversation actually becomes the emergence of something new that can make a difference. We've got to somehow hold ourselves in this conversation with that kind of tender but courageous expectancy, like being that prayer as we speak.
That is so beautiful what you said, and it really moves me, because I think that you're speaking about the central mystery of the birth of a new humanity. I think we have had a whole slew of unbelievable teachers now, great messengers from the past and great masters that have been here in the recent present, but that we're all being challenged now to claim our own divine realization, to rise up to the height of our own truest, deepest selves, and to enter very vulnerably together into a conversation and into the action flowing from that conversation that have never happened before. And that this birth is not the birth of a new religion, it's not the birth of a whole new mystical master system, master-disciple system. It's the birth of what Aurobindo called Gnostic individuals, beings who realize the essence of their own divine truth and share it with open-heartedness with others, willing to change, to shift, to grow in any way that they're asked by the situation. I think one of the great dangers of being, as I know you and I both are, so deeply admiring of the great ones, is that you can be indulging what I call the golden shadow, that you can be, in your adoration of them, projecting onto them your own unlived divine potential. And this is why I've really taken such a stance against the guru system, because I feel that in so many ways the guru system keeps alive a very subtle dualism which prevents at the highest reaches this birth of each human being as their own unique Christ or Buddha or prophet. And that now what you and I and the other teachers who are coming into this true new mode are discovering is actually something very much subtler and much more difficult. It's much more difficult to be in this space because you have no protection. You have no protection from a system. You can't pose as enlightened because you've understood that enlightenment is a constantly expanding field. You can't pose as omniscient because you've already accepted that to be
no immunity, immunity, no place to hide,
no immunity. No protection, no shelter, no role that gives you dignity. Your only authority is love. Your only authority is the quality of your response. Isn't that amazing? I find it very liberating, actually.
It is in the breaking beyond my known ways of being, breaking beyond the Terry I'm used to being, in an actual creative act. In some sense, this really is all about the liberation of creativity in those that, you know, those that I teach. You know, it's even interesting, like the old language, teacher-student.
Yes, even that is an inadequate language, right.
It really is like we need to become the beloved community. We need to love and empower those that we so-called teach. We need to be entering into a communion in which a different kind of human society finds moments of its reality and begins to come into being. It's as if we convene a fragment of that new human society in any true moment of our work, and more that needs to happen, and it needs to catch fire. Those who I teach will in time be catching fire outside my company and passing that fire along to others. If we are successful in this moment, we will be forgotten. We will be subsumed
in something.
You will become
obsolete. That's our dream, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. Because the thing
we will
that
write
will
ourselves
come,
out of the hearts of it, those who have been inflamed by their own inspiration.
Exactly. The thing that will come into being will be so glorious that trying to find somebody to give credit to it in the past, that's part of the old paradigm that's being subsumed in something new and richer. And if we can
except
be...
There will always be gratitude, won't there? I think it's
there
so
really
important.
Will.
It will be gratitude, and it will be gratitude for one's sacred friends, not one's masters or teachers.
Yes,
it will be gratitude for those who have taught us the depths of ourselves. It will be a wholly new egalitarian web of sacred relationship. And that is the mother's way. That's the shamanic way. That's the ancient way. Before all these mystical systems grew, all these patriarchal mystical systems grew, when you are with an African shaman, when you're with an Aboriginal shaman, and I've been spending a lot of time recently with Aboriginal shamans, the idea that they think they're special and that everybody should do whatever they say is so absurd to them that if you suggest it, they just fall about laughing and reach for a drink or a smoke just to deconstruct any fantasy that you might have about them.
Yeah.
And what they're really teaching me is to uncover my own inner aborigine and inner shaman, and that as I'm doing so, my love for them grows, but my sense of my own power and my own capacity to be
right.
unified brass and the animals and the stones grow. This,
right.
to me, is the authentic system, and it's very much more demanding than the other.
Well, you know, it isn't even, I'm in a moment of reappreciating and reconnecting with my guru, root guru, Adi Da, and feeling not, you know, it's funny to be, I wrote an essay some years ago, Defiant Devotion.
I love that phrase.
Yeah, just utter refusal to
yes.
be made small, you know, the
yes.
the demotion that's hidden in devotion so often, that a refusal
yes.
of that. But
so
but,
what is he becoming for you? I think even the word guru is probably not adequate, is it?
Well, it's probably true, and I haven't found a new name for it, but it's a
Well,
just a recognition of the indwelling divinity that radiated from his every moment, you know, that quality of consciousness and embodied divinity that communicated to me, you know, I've told you this story of being in his company and feeling him, feeling all the pain of the world, just resonating, just that unbuffered explosion, 360 degree of feeling everything completely, and all of the crucifixion of the devastation of all the pain of every creature in every dimension of this reality coinciding with exquisite blissfulness. I mean, he's given
yes.
me so much. I'm eternally grateful. I, in some sense, always just adore him. And yet,
yes.
I will often gather with other devotees of Adi Da, and there will be this locating of God in him as if it's not in them, a locating
That's
of God
it.
In him as if it's not in everyone, a cultism that I don't even feel like making them wrong. I just... It's just the continual movement of the divine needs to break loose of that bond. And this aliveness and communion and the coming together of a, like any two human hearts. You know, you and I, when we're really just going for it, you know, it is like Shams and Rumi. But it should be
yeah,
like that between
beloved,
every
beloved.
Two of us. It should begin to grow like that between every two of us, every three of us.
Yes.
It should be a kind of celebration.
I think you mentioned a really incredible relationship. I think that was Shams and Rumi's devastating radicalism, because, of course, the Sufi tradition has attempted to describe Shams as Rumi's master, but if you really explore the relationship, and especially if you read Shams's notes and his makamad, you see that Rumi was an astounding blessing to Shams, and he pours his love out for Rumi and his amazement at Rumi.
Mm.
And we know from Rumi's poetry how amazed and astounded he was by Shams. So what happened between them, I think, is the model of precisely this new relationship that we're describing. What happened between them is that they, in each other, met their heart beloved. And that beloved, beloved relationship is what you and I should be having with the people who come to hear us talk and to receive whatever instruction we can give.
Mm.
And it should be the core of whatever relationship you and I have and what all teachers have with each other.
Yeah.
It is the authentic relationship of the universe. Everything is the beloved of the beloved, and uncovering that and living that is the key.
It is. And it's interesting for both of us. You're so eloquent, you know, you're such a fount of poetry. And that's less famously than you, but this is also a quality that people appreciate in me. And I know we both are aware that there is a certain, hypnotic, falling in love with the sound of our own voice kind of thing.
Oh, my God, yes.
It's so important to transcend. It's so important to come into the to be the clear channel through which that which is beyond the Terry Act or the Andrew Act can find its way into expression for us to really, really attend in that spirit of Sobet,
yes.
Voice of the heart, the ear of the heart, the deeper, deepest place. It's beckoning us.
Definitely, because when you were talking about coming into this new beloved relationship, you mentioned the rigor of it, but actually, what I'm discovering is something that I would say goes even further. I think that you have to be able to die into each moment, that what's required is a death to any previous self that you've manufactured. And that also, especially for teachers, and especially for those of us who have been given a charism of eloquence, requires the capacity to sacrifice that eloquence, to burn it away when the heart wants to speak far more simply.
Yeah.
And sometimes stumblingly, because if you can't stumble, you can't find the new. If you know what you're going to say, you can't find what the Spirit wants you to say.
Yeah.
And don't you think one of the great penalties of teaching is that you repeat yourself because you become so enamored and excited by the formulations you've discovered that you find yourself redecorating them with more and more chutzpah and exuberance, but actually what you're doing is entombing your soul. I spend a lot of time in my analysis. I have the great grace of having an amazing analyst, somebody whom I'd been on a very deep journey with for 9 years.
No, wonderful.
Short to land. And he is constantly saying to me, don't poison your soul with what you already know. Always be vulnerable. And always be setting sail for what you've never even begun to imagine.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear you say that. I mean,
he has to say it a lot to me, because, as you say, you can get imprisoned in one's own gifts. This is one of the subtle temptations, isn't it? It's a subtle death, actually.
And that, you see, that aliveness in you that recognizes the truth of that and then leans forward and wants then to stumble, wants then to break beyond the ready clarities that would push forward, that then is more alive to the unknowableness of the thing that is here ready to emerge, that is more than what we already know. Like, I'm in the presence of that with you. That's,
me too.
See, it's out of that I love these conversations with you so much, and love you, because I'm not with the personality, the already formed, formidable Andrew Harvey. I'm with the aliveness of that spirit that is the thing that, you're a gift to me there. You're an opening to me there. You're not crowding the space with the bigness of you. You're a portal into the unknowable then. Then
absolutely.
I'm ennobled by this.
And we're relating. It's about embodiment, isn't it? If you're in your body and in your heart and in the present, then you're always moving out towards the other. You're not waiting for the other to stop talking so that you can pull your own truth in.
Right.
And don't you find that the most amazing moments of teaching are when somebody gets up and says something that you've never heard and asks a question that really flummoxes you, really floors you by its brilliance or by its rage or by its mystery, and that you have to summon up all of your past and burn it away and then jump into the furnace of the present and answer as best you can in a very vulnerable way. Something miraculous happens in those moments.
Yes. Yes. Those are the moments. And it, it's interesting to me, and I feel even, called to be a better man by my awareness that sometimes it really is the presence of a whole group. Sometimes it is the supercharging of the moment by external factors that is a key ingredient in how I will break forth. You know,
key. Jesus said, you know, when two or three are gathered together in my name, the Christ consciousness comes. You enter a field, and that field immeasurably ennobles and inspires everybody who's in it, and we're all taken to a new level of mystery if we are able to embrace it. That's what keeps me loving teaching, is not the parade of what I think I have already learned, but the opportunity to enter that field with other loving, seeking souls and being taken through that field into places that I have never imagined. That's what keeps me alive. That's what keeps my work alive.
It is. It is. And that aliveness is precious, and it is always under threat. So many people who I've really been served by and who I deeply, deeply respect and appreciate the gifts of, you know, I'll catch them in moments where they're in an eddy of this type of growth, where they're repeating themselves, where they're performing, where they're not in that place of fresh discovery. And I can see how profoundly this trap of that you've described just now, of this falling in love with our own voice kind of thing, you know, corrupt something in the environment of spiritual teachings and personal growth. I want to interrupt the recording for a moment to make sure you know how to find out more about Andrew Harvey's work. First and foremost, I highly recommend his books, including The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism, Heart Yoga, The Sacred Marriage of Yoga and Mysticism, Light the Flame, 365 Days of Prayer, The Way of Passion, A Celebration of Rumi, The Sun at Midnight, A Memoir of the Dark Night, and there are many more, about 30. He's a remarkably prolific mystical writer. If you're resonating with this dialogue, I recommend The Hope and the Teachings of Rumi, especially. Andrew also wants me to let you know about his Sacred Warriorship excursion. You can join him and Linda Tucker for a Sacred Warriorship excursion to Thembavati, South Africa. The itinerary includes techniques to speak with the Sacred White Lion, as well as commingling with sacred leadership teachers and spiritual activists. Many participants of past years' excursions have dubbed this the single most life-changing week of their lives. The awe and sheer beauty of the African plains combined with the majestic wildlife facilitates meditation and inspiration like no other. Andrew and Linda have done their best to make this trip as affordable as possible so as many as possible may attend. Additionally, I want you to be aware of some of my own offerings. As my inner life has grown, I've been drawn to an expansion of the integral spirituality that animates me in a way that I'm calling integral soul work. It has to do with trust, with asking, with listening, and with discovering and partnering with the greater power of the universe in a very unique and empowered way. At the beginning of this year, I decided to share this work with two small circles of students, and I gave a talk to introduce that program. You can download it at integralsoulwork.com. And you're also invited to experience integral soul work with me in person if you're in Mexico and Guatemala at the end of November and the beginning of December. I'll be teaching there. And there will be other events in the United States posted for 2015. To find out more detail about my work in general and about these events, please go to terrypatton.com and sign up for my mailing list. If you click events, you'll find out more details and a link to the registration pages for each of these things. Okay, back to our dialogue with Andrew. I think that the new generation is wise to that. I think
Oh, I find them very wise to that. They just shut down if I'm in that mode. And if I'm watching carefully, I'm absolutely gobsmacked by the new alertness to this kind of authoritarian imposition of the known.
Right.
They're not interested, especially the young. They won't listen to anybody who isn't absolutely with them, listening to their hearts.
Yeah.
And why should they?
Thank goodness. I mean, I think we need to be, in part, I mean, well, I aspire to be a participant in a turning so that we can function a little bit as a hinge. I mean, we really have been given, you even more than I mean, the great beings who you were able to spend time with in your youth and who I was able to spend time with in my youth, the kind of lineage, inheritance, and legacy that then, you know, has been impressed on the very protoplasm, you know, the cells themselves have been baked by that intense transmissive company of these great, great beings. And we are of use. We do have a gift. But the more, because we're so, you know, we've lived it, it's there in us, we're aware of it, we can become oppressive, cranky old men telling people stories about their youth if we aren't alive only, you know, dedicated only, in love only, with the real thing in the next moment. And then if we're really participating humbly, ready to learn from people 20, 30, 40 years younger than we are, really, really interested in what is going to emerge that's new, really interested in what can come out of a kind of collaboration in which our humility just barely leads our wisdom, our elderhood, you know, so that's actually the place where we're even more alive, then maybe we can be a contribution to the whole pattern evolving in our time. And the old model of the you know, the few in every generation who are actually realized passing the baton to the few in the next generation, and
oh,
it always being
shit,
about
yeah.
people gathering around those few rare beings and the schools and the venerable everybody, the retinue that always has to be invoked, the way in which it makes
circus,
everybody
yeah.
small. Yeah.
Yes, it's a circus. I've just been plunging into Kabir's work and recreating Kabir's poems for 3 years quietly, because Kabir is the most ruthless destroyer of all this spiritual circus. He says again and again and again, oh, pundits and gurus, shut up. The beloved is in everybody, and it's our task who's found the beloved, who are finding the beloved, to inspire that in others. And the only way we could ever call ourselves successful is, as you say, to be forgotten, to be the ones who help others light the lamp in their own hearts. And we can only do that, I think, if we stay prostrate on the ground before the one, that we stay on our knees before the mystery. And
I would correct you on that, Andrew. You can't, I don't think that's right. I don't think you can stay. I think that you have to find it anew every damn moment.
Yes, you're right.
The me that tries to stay thinks he knows something.
I didn't mean it like that. I think when I say stay prostrate before the beloved, that's a commitment to always knowing you don't know, because the one is always immeasurably greater and wiser than any formulations that the one may out of grace give you. So that's what I mean by, but I hear you. You've got to be able to flow like water, right?
And to me, it's the miracle of it is that I have to just keep getting off of it. So the sense of discovery and the real presence, the living presence, the scintillating, iridescent aliveness, the juiciness, the sexiness, the playfulness, the incredible creativity that is the very nature of the divine, I get to rediscover that. I become so joyful in this relationship because I'm not involved in the dead thing I already know. I'm in that moment of discovery again and again. And the cultivation of that in my own heart is, just endlessly marvelous. It's so...
And it's fun, isn't it? Because I think that's so many great teachers who get stuck in their own shtick stop radiating the kind of playfulness and joyfulness and sheer sheer humor. That is, I think, one of the most glorious parts, which I'm discovering more and more, of the divine presence. That's what makes His Holiness such an enchanting being, is not only that He has all this grandeur and realization, but that He's absolutely in the presence and He's always foaming over with naughtiness.
Yeah.
It's staying naughty in that high, glorious sense that's important. I don't think Americans appreciate the sacred virtue of naughtiness enough. It's something that I'm very happy to be British in only that way, because there's an irreverence and naughtiness that's very much part of the British temperament that I value.
Well, that's true. They do, don't
God,
they?
God, I'm looking at my cats now. They teach me naughtiness, the sacred naughtiness, every single moment of the day. One of my cats, Jade, who is the girl, and my other cat is a boy, and he's a beautiful, beautiful boy, but he's a macho, and he's always trying to rule her, and she lets him, but whenever he falls asleep, she goes and gives him a bath, and then runs away and hides in her favorite hiding place, while he sort of stumbles and tries to look for her. And this just doubles me up, because it reminds me, and I think that we can get so overwhelmed by the seriousness of the world, so overwhelmed by the seriousness of really responding, that we forget that one of the ways in which we stay most nourished is by staying in the flow of the humor of God that's always flowing.
And it's very close to yeah, it's very close to our sexiness too, and our eros, our playfulness.
Yes.
That thing that can be kind of sassily proud of an erection, or just seductively confrontive. That aliveness, it is, that's the thing. Evolution isn't just in our hearts. It is absolutely. It's not just in our imaginations. It is absolutely. It's in our loins too, and that's the first place
most people
contact it.
I think if it isn't in your loins, you're not evolved. I think that getting it into the loins and allowing the loins to dance in it is actually one of the greatest challenges all of us face, with all of the miserable body hatred and sex hatred that we've inherited from actually most of the traditions. In my case, it's been a huge journey to liberate more and more the sexual Andrew, because it has been partly such a painful process, but also you have to face all kinds of things about yourself when you do, and accept them with humor.
And, I think for me, the affirmation of that sexuality it can be confusing, because you can then let sexuality take up too much space, and finding a way of saying yes, but not too big, not such a big yes that you become inappropriately concentrated there. Like, in a way that is degrading, in just the ways that the original prohibitions legitimately observed.
Right, it's riding the tiger, isn't it? The tantric traditions say that if you really want to become authentically tantric, you have to be prepared to learn how to ride the tiger. If you fall off into excess and indulgence, then you get eaten by the tiger. But if you learn to ride with dynamic balance this great force, and with humor and with tenderness and with always a commitment to the other, to the compassion for the other, then it becomes a source of immeasurably deepened love. I meet a lot of people that I feel deeply attracted to, but if I followed the attraction in inappropriate ways, instead of allowing the attraction and then transmuting it into deeper and deeper love, I would be screwed. And that's what happens when you unleash the sexual energy. You've got to balance it with deep relatedness and compassion and a profound sense of what is appropriate and necessary and valuable to the other. You've got to do so in an absolute commitment to the real relationship between people being erotic compassion.
It is true, I think, that this particular type of sexuality is a circuitry that completes itself at the heart. If that
yes, if it's not
deep lovingness isn't primary, then
yeah.
the sexuality that flows is worth renouncing. That is worth renouncing.
Denounce it, because the truth is, and I know you know this, Terry, and I believe you've experienced it, is that it's incredibly liberating to experience just wild, raw sexuality for its own sake. I remember when I first came to New York when I was in my late 20s, from a very repressive, sex-hating, body-hating English culture, to actually dance for a while in the wildness of the scene in New York was unbelievably liberating. But if you stay there, it becomes a prison. So I think there's always, in the education of any tantric, a moment where you have to explore without fear all the different aspects of your sexuality, but you also have to keep one eye very beady on yourself that you're not becoming obsessed and compulsive. And it's a hard game. And I think you make many mistakes. I certainly did, and everybody I've ever observed closely have. But those mistakes teach you precisely the wisdom of what we're trying to go towards now. Don't you agree?
I think, yes. I've been observing in myself that and I've been talking, as I do this integral soul work, I've been talking about soul trauma, which is obviously intimately related to the whole field of trauma and attachment so many people are working with. But this sense that somehow at a deep-rooted place in an existential level that I am, number one, not already related to the divine and to love, and that if I just let things go the way they would naturally go, there was for me a displacement where I really thought I had to earn my connection to God and to love, that I had to work hard, that I had to have a victory over a hostile world that was structured as a struggle to survive even. And
that's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and then and part and parcel for me, part and parcel of that was a deep conviction that something about me wasn't good, wasn't lovable, wasn't even sexually appealing. Like I had to rediscover my own lovability, and then and part of that had to be worked out in bodily sexual love, because only in the human embrace of someone who does open to and swoon, kind of really feel and see and let themselves even be tantrically initiated by that loving divinity that I am in an embodied way, and have that really make a difference and catalyze a change in their being, could I begin to let go of this deep, dark belief, distrust, this loss of contact. And so I think that sexuality can play a profound role in this waking up from this traumatized condition, which is the necessary precondition for us to meet one another in a place that isn't then remedial or therapeutic or problem based.
Absolutely. I think. Have you ever been to Kajuraho and seen the great tantric temples there?
No, I haven't. I've seen the pictures of those amazing reliefs, though. My God.
Oh, they're absolutely gobsmackingly beautiful. And one of the things that slowly and amazingly they teach you, on the one hand, they're extremely wild and every possible combination is going on. But on the other hand, what you're watching, if you really watch, is great serenity and great compassion also at play in tremendous sexuality and freedom. So they're very instructional. They do actually help you get to the stage in which you're free to be sexual or not be sexual. Mm. And that, I think, is the key. If you are compulsively drawn to work out your desire in possession, you're in the old paradigm. If you allow the desire to flood you and then allow it to awaken your heart towards the person and establish then a relationship based and grounded and founded primarily in the heart, then whatever happens then, whether it is actually sexual or not sexual, doesn't matter. It's filled with divine eros.
Exactly. I think that's a key thing, because there are so many people who are now waking into a very juicy and totally post-conventional relationship to spirit and sex, some of whom are celibate, some of whom are really appreciating the freedom from that level of drama and plunging heart deep into their spiritual life in a way that's very juicy and very tantric.
If you're not capable of long periods of celibacy, you can't tune your whole ear to the right level of precision. Mm. I think that the ideal tantric life, which I'm trying to lead myself, is always a periods of tender celibacy in which you're making love to love itself in the creation and everything.
Right.
With the grace of finding somebody that you can actually explore it physically and emotionally and spiritually. And if you're not prepared to go through those periods of austerity, of rigor, of real love of the beloved in love as the creation, you will never attain that mysterious balance. You just won't.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you find that?
I'm in a moment of really deep surrender, in which the things I've learned, I realize that so much of what I learned in moments in which aspects of that deeper trauma, soul trauma, sexual trauma, were only incompletely released, and therefore what I have tended to think I know is I'm ready to let go of it. And the tentative conclusions are preliminary to a revelation that is still alive, pieces of which might still be beyond my horizon. And it's my fidelity to the purity with which I can learn the next thing that's really my only home. My only home is, you know, that this esoteric mystical life is its performance art, and it's my next moment, my ability to meet it with trust of God, trust of the next moment, trust of emergence, trust of evolution, trust of my heart, trust of my being, trust of it all.
And don't force anything. That's the key, isn't it? I'm learning more and more about my shadow of forcing. Don't force anything.
Mm.
Don't compel anybody to go into the next tantric explosion. Don't try and make anybody anything. I love what Krishnamurti said once. He said, when he was asked, have you ever helped anybody? And he answered, never on purpose. I have a deeper and deeper faith that if sacred friendships are meant to be, they will happen. If sacred tantric relationships are meant to be, they will evolve. The more I get out of the way, the less I do, the more I love, simply, nakedly, the more I allow this supremely beautiful and playful intelligence to bring the people into my life that my life is hungry for.
Yeah. That trust.
There's this wonderful thing in Rumi. He says, well, if only you'd sit quietly, the whole treasures of the world would be rolled to you. It's your inability to sit quietly and trust and just believe that your life is being guided by a much greater intelligence than you will ever understand. It's only that that will give you the life you so deeply want.
Well, this relaxation of anxiety, this is what I had to do in this last period of time. Just seeing, number one, I was in a particularly trying moment in my life, and I was feeling fairly gross levels of anxiety and needing, you know, in a very deep and human way to let it go. And it had to do with a very deep and profound and very real recognition that there was something reflexive. You know, the Adi Dai used to always talk about the self-contraction being a present activity. And I've found that so useful because it gives me a place to be compassionate toward the resurgence of contraction and to say, okay, well, it just tends to happen. And so there was a reorienting again and again and again in so many moments and a letting go of that anxiety and a recognition, no, wait, that is superficial to something more fundamental that I can trust, and trusting and really making a decision to live a life based on that trust. And as I did that, then I began to discover that there were subtler and subtler and subtler levels of anxiety, and that
yes,
even the most ordinary level of thinking was really rooted in what tends to be an unexamined and pervasive anxiety that pervades almost all our cultural and human exchanges. That we're all so
caught. I think it's
caught
a primordial anxiety. I think it's at the root of matter, don't you? I think that it's. Aurobindo talks about the cobra coiled around the heart of matter, and for me, that cobra is a kind of primordial, ferocious anxiety at being incarnated at all. I think it goes right down to the bottom of being in form. And as you peel away the anxieties that come from your biography, from your trauma, from your betrayals, and from the betrayals that you've done of others, and from the world situation, you come closer and closer to this primordial anxiety, and then you can, with great trust and humor and deep surrender, start training the divine light on that primordial anxiety so that it can over time grow softer. This is what Aurobindo himself was doing more and more as his life grew in his great adventure into incarnation and to embodiment. And I find it extraordinary how, as you peel away the levels of anxiety, you realize that they're all just offshoots of the primordial anxiety of being in form at all and dying.
Yes. Adi Da called it vital shock, and he talked
vital
also
shock,
like...
Great phrase.
Yeah. He talked also, like Aurobindo, about this divination of the body itself, this divination
yes.
of the very protoplasm, the cells, the molecules. And I love that you're pointing out that it goes even below the biological level, even to matter itself. Because I think I'm far from being able to take responsibility for that, but I have enough sensitivity that I've been in these spaces intimately associated with Adi Da and Meher Baba and others.
Well, have you ever read The Agenda by the Mother? It's such an extraordinary book, or the books by Sat Prem about The Agenda, because in her 90s, the mother, you know, who was Aurobindo's partner,
yes.
discovered, I think, which is the key discovery, really, for the transmutation process, she discovered that the cells themselves are in a desperate and dreadful habit of believing themselves to be mortal and to be dying. And because they're such obedient little things, they've interjected this belief, and that's why they're quivering with this primordial anxiety.
Mm.
And so she set about digging right down into the depths of the cells and teaching them a new message, a message of expansiveness, a message potentially of immortality. And this was her overwhelming discovery. It was what enabled her to do the astonishing work she did before she left her body or whatever happened at the end of her life. And Sat Prem talks about it extraordinarily in what I think are the really amazing books about time, the Evolution 1 and Evolution 2, and he describes exactly how he uncovers it in his own body. And I've been truly trying to work at that level, because until you do, I find, until you're really trying to retrain the cells themselves, all the talk of flooding the body with light and divinizing the body is just talk, because you'll always come up against that dark message that the cells have been giving themselves for now millennia in our dying world. And really, you have to reprogram them. It's not easy. It's terribly difficult, and it is a very new kind of work because it's not about going into divine consciousness so much. It's about bringing the deep trust and the deep spaciousness and the rapture that you know when you are in transcendence down into the very dark, swarming, reptilian depths of cellular matter. Mm-hmm. And that's grueling work, but it's amazing how over
time... Well, it has to be blissful, too, it would seem. I mean, grueling, maybe, but somehow...
Oh, it is
incredibly ecstatic.
You're going to meet a lot of resistance. There's a lot of resistance down there. That's the resistance that prevents the ultimate divinization of the body. So the grueling comes from patiently facing that resistance. And my experience is that it's a resistance actually greater than even the resistance of the mind or of the emotions. It's more brutal because it's more primordial. So you've got to be prepared for that. But of course the bliss that comes with each advance through grace is immense.
You know, all I have in my own experience that corresponds to this is simply the experience of having been in Adida's company when he has outshined the room so profoundly that my cells have emerged just singing light. And then this finding myself in graceful moments in my own meditation at home and occasionally in other circumstances, finding...
Dancing does it, don't you find? And deep love and sexuality do it. There's amazing moments.
They absolutely do. Well, yes, for me, less in orgasm than in...
tantric
intensity without it,
yes, exactly. And also in the tremendous peace that comes from lovemaking, in that great sea that both beings subside into.
It really is a great sunlit expansiveness that we do float in. And there is a discovery that we are floating in it that occasionally breaks through. But I think you may be talking about a very specific...
I find, but actually being breathed by it. This is something that I'm just beginning to experience. I took ayahuasca twice, once in the Amazon, and that was an amazing experience, and then once in Santa Barbara, and I looked out at the hills around Santa Barbara and I saw for the first time that I've ever seen it how emptiness breathes matter. That I really understood at the cellular level what Milarepa means by the whole creation being blossoms of emptiness. It's a breathing of shunyata. And you're floating and you're being breathed because you've surrendered. And that surrender enables you to feel that floating breathing, which is so peaceful and so blissful.
And it's what's happening right this second.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening all the time. Yeah, but I mean, isn't it beautiful and tender that we are always in this amazing dance in which the thing itself, which is always beyond words, rises up, and then my ability to take a perspective on it and to give it voice does something good and creative with it, but then also needs to be outshined by the thing itself. And it is like a breathing. Those are like two movements, almost like an inhalation and an exhalation, that are just inherent in ecstatic apprehension of being.
That's it. That's it. I love what the Sufis say, that after fana, after annihilation, comes baka, the subsistence in essence. And that essence is always breathing. It's always peaceful. It's always tender. It's always open and spacious because it has nothing to hide. It doesn't need to hide anything. It's endlessly exploring its own creative possibilities. And if you can subside into it, it will enable you to explore your own unique marriage with that essence in ways that just continue to astound and transform you.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be a lovely place to read a poem. Can I read a poem of Kabir?
Yes, please.
I'm in the Kabir mode. I love, love, love Kabir. In fact, sometimes I think Kabir is more the poet of our time even than Rumi, because Kabir is so no-nonsense and so get down to it, and such an assassin of the full self. My God, he is God's hired assassin, this one.
Mm.
He says, enlightenment has nothing to do with becoming better or richer or smarter or happier. It cannot be bought or sold in the ego's bazaar. In its cool, fierce fire, all untruth burns away. All illusion is ashed. Everything you believed real vanishes in smoke. So what remains? You can't describe it, but you can know and live it. Kabir says, give everything you are to know and live that what you now call life and what you think is death has never stained the wonder of wonders and can never destroy it.
This unthreatened field. Thank you.
Thank him, my God. What a genius. Oh, and what a tough, tough guy. And what a beautiful, holy, universal presence. And it's ours. Because we all have an inner Kabir.
And we live in this time of incredible riches. No one has lived like we do, with all of these great founts of poetry, all of these esoteric.
And that's
schools.
Not the only riches. We have the great gift of an almost terminal crisis to get us real. The gifts are on both sides. The dark is giving us a terrible and amazing gift and absolutely shattering every single illusion and pretension that we might have. And here we have also all the treasures of all the mystical traditions. So there's a sword and a rose, and they're both gifts, aren't they?
Mm. And on so many levels, because not only do we have that, but we have the positive gifts of Western modernity and rational thought, and the incredible mobility we have to travel and connect, and the internet, and the riches of information and entertainment and art and everything informing us. We're both the luckiest and the most profoundly challenged people who've ever lived.
And so we have no possible excuse not to act in sacred activism, do we? Because we've been given, on the one hand, the priceless gift of a potentially terminal crisis that challenges us all to get awake, and on the other hand, every single source of beauty and inspiration that anyone could need to become strong enough to meet that challenge.
That's right. And we're
passion.
Also in the midst of it, given the profound challenge of the numbing and deadening, soporific powers of this, all of the hypnotic deadening that is so, so insidious and so...
Like Coca-Coma, I call it, yeah.
Yeah, that Coca-Coma.
Yes.
Yeah. I like that. That's great.
I'm rather proud of that Andrew Harveyism. I shouldn't be, but I am. It is the Coca-Coma.
You're so... I love you, Andrew.
I love you, Tay. What a lovely chance to share, to shoot the sacred breeze. Thank you.
Yeah, really, 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 really. I so love our conversations. Okay, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us for this basement tape. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you're interested in learning more about Andrew Harvey, remember you can go to andrewharvey.net to find out more. You're also invited to go to terrypatton.com to sign up for my personal mailing list and newsletter.
Thank you so much for joining Andrew and me today. Goodbye, everybody. Thanks for joining us.